Now, first things first. Here is Senator Ervin's statement on how he would have the term impeachment and all that it implies defined.
One of the mysteries to me is why so many great legal scholars want to interpret the provision of a constitution to mean what it would have said if they, instead of the founding fathers, had written it. And I find that particularly true in the question of impeachment. Now, this Constitution was written by a convention presided over by George Washington. And among its members was Benjamin Franklin, Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, George Mason, James Wilson. And they were pretty smart people. And most of them had read Blackstone's Commentaries on the Law of England, which was a legal Bible of most of the members that sat in that convention. And Blackstone, speaking of impeachable offenses, said there had to be for some existing law, a violation of some existing law, as I read him. His men, their mother tongue was English. And here's what they wrote in the Constitution about impeachable offenses in very plain English. Section 4 of Article 2, the President, Vice President, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, robbery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Then in Section 2 of the next article, Article 3, it says the trial of all crimes, except in cases of impeachment, shall be by jury. I think these people knew what the word crime meant. And I think that they were trying to trying to get away from the English system. The history of England shows that the House of Commons impeached and the House of Lords convicted public officials in England for any conduct which was displeasing to the Parliament. Didn't have to be a criminal offense, anything, political crimes. For example, they couldn't reach the king, so when the king acted in a very foolish manner, they impeached and removed from office the ministers. His ministers on the ground, they gave him bad advice. And I don't think bad advice has ever been a crime, although it perhaps ought to be. So I think it would be a misfortune. I think they wanted to make the president independent. And then in the field assigned by the Constitution to his special jurisdiction. And they didn't want the English system. So the road here, he could only be impeached for treason, robbery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. And misdemeanors. Misdemeanor had a well-defined meaning in the law, a crime less than a felony. And I would have said a few years ago before the Powell case that the courts wouldn't have any jurisdiction in this field. It was then thought that that this was the sole function of Congress to impeach a civil officer of the federal government. But in the Powell case, the Supreme Court held, and I think quite wisely, that the House could not deny a seat to a man who possessed the three qualifications for Congress, the House of Representatives, the age of 25 years, citizenship for 7 years, and residence in the state from which he's elected. And so they held that Representative Powell was entitled to be seated. Now, if the court has jurisdiction to say that a man must be seated in Congress if he possesses the constitutional qualifications, I think the Supreme Court would have power to say you can't remove a public official from office by the impeachment process except by the standard prescribed by the Constitution, which is treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors, not a lack of wisdom, but a degree of criminality. And If you can't deny a man a seat in Congress, he possesses the constitutional qualifications, then you can't remove a man from office except by the standard prescribed in the Constitution. And if we don't go by the standard prescribed in the Constitution, we have no standard whatever, and we have no independent president, the very object that the founding fathers were trying to establish. That has nothing to do with this hearing, but it's interesting to me. It does collaterally have something to do with the hearing.
Senator Ervin, in his statement, seemed to be doing more than just disclosing how he would have the word impeachment defined. One got the impression that he was using the platform the hearings on the Justice Department allowed him to send a signal flare to his colleagues in the House, where definitions over what constitute impeachable offenses are being warmly discussed. Senator Ervin's message seemed to be, cut out the verbiage, if not the debating, and get down to fundamentals. Indeed, our thoughts seemed justified as the senator proceeded during the following interview with us at the conclusion of that day's hearing. Visiting with us is Senator Ervin. Welcome to our microphone, Senator.
Well, thank you. I want to commend the carrying of this hearings because I think that we are dealing with something that's crucial to the restoration of confidence of people in government. And we are diagnosing the condition of the patient and receiving different prescriptions from different doctors as to how we can best correct the unfortunate situation which we find ourselves in as a result of the loss of confidence in the executive branch of the government, particularly in the Department of Justice.
I inferred that from a number of your remarks this morning, Senator. One of them was of particular interest and wasn't entirely on the point, as you yourself admitted. You said it might be a matter of pertinency, but it certainly was a matter of interest to you, and that was your definition on how people are now going about, mysteriously, and that was the word you used, defining what impeachment meant. And I wonder if you could elaborate a little further on that and why you may have brought that up at this session.
Well, I'm a great... I think that one of the mysterious things, as I said, was why so many people, including many learned scholars, when they undertake to interpret a provision of the Constitution, interpret it to mean what would have said if they, instead of the founding fathers, had written it. Now, the Constitution, in the fourth section of Article 2, very plainly says that the President, the Vice President, and any other civil officer of the United States may be impeached for or on conviction removed from office for treason, bribery, or other high crimes or misdemeanors. Then the second section of Article 3 says the trial of all cases except in cases of impeachment. The trial of all crimes except in cases of impeachment shall be by jury. I think that these words mean what to say and not something else. And I think that under this that a president or a vice president or other civil officer of the federal government can be impeached only for treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. He can't be impeached for anything else. And if we don't take the standard which the Constitution sets forth, we have no standard whatever. And I think that this was put in the Constitution to make it certain that we'd have a president who was independent of the other branches of government in the field assigned to him by the Constitution. And I think it's crucial to our system of government.
Well, Senator, as you well know, there's been distinctions made by numerous people involved and not involved on this subject regarding the definition of the term impeachment. Are you saying there's been too much word flailing, that we should stick to what the Constitution says and not go about with with the various definitions that are now being thrown about?
We've got a 12-inch ruler supplied by the Constitution to use a figure of speech, and some people want to stretch it to where it's just a 6-inch ruler instead of a 12-inch ruler. And I think if we don't adhere to the standard of the Constitution, we have no standard whatever except the whim and caprice of the Congress.
Well, two important questions then. One, if a definition is supplied that's not in accord with the Constitution, where might that lead us?
It'll lead us away from a government of
loss into a governor mend.
And secondly, why do you think all this is going on?
Well, because of the human desire to interpret a provision of the Constitution as a say in them, and to have it mean what it would have said if the interpreter had written the Constitution instead of the Founding Fathers.
Now, remember during the Watergate hearings, many times the subject of a man's motivation was brought up, not only by yourself, but particularly by your vice chairman, who did go into the motivations. I'm wondering what your motivation is in bringing the subject of impeachment up at these particular hearings. What is the connection, or what is your reason?
Well, it was really brought up by the suggestion of a question from Senator Mathias. But I think it's a very timely subject that is distantly related to what we're investigating. And I think it's essential for the Congress to proceed upon sound constitutional grounds instead of following some will-o'-the-wisp out into some strange territory.
Is it your feeling, then, that the House Judiciary Committee perhaps is spending a little too much time wondering about what the definition of impeachment is rather than getting down to basics?
Yes, and I'm also not in harmony with those who suggest that the House Judiciary Committee should define what impeachable defenses are in advance. The House Judiciary Committee acts like a grand jury, and a grand jury always has the evidence before it presents a bill of indictment. And it's sort of ridiculous to determine what impeachment charges you're going to make when you haven't heard the evidence and don't know what the evidence would justify.
What about the idea that perhaps the defense counsel should sit in on these investigations by the House Judiciary Committee?
Well, I think that reasonable men can each reach different conclusions on that. Since the House Judiciary Committee acts as a grand jury, and a grand jury doesn't try the case, it just merely determines whether there's evidence of a probable cause to present articles of impeachment, you might well exclude them. But on the contrary, I think in the interest of having a sense, satisfying a sense of fair play, I see no objection to allowing the attorneys for the president to sit in and cross-examine the witnesses.
You have no objection to
that? No. I don't think it's required, because I think that counsel for the defendant is excluded from a grand jury proceeding. But I think that if I was a member of the committee, I would probably favor allowing the counsel for the president to sit in and ask questions.
Senator, I remember a year ago we had a conversation of this nature a month or so prior to the opening of the Watergate hearings. And with clarity, you anticipated what might be the general outcome of those hearings. I wonder if, looking ahead now, and trying to visualize what might be the outcome of what's going on now, is it possible to do so, or do you think perhaps we're on a railroad train with the track being built 100 yards ahead of us every day?
Well, I have, having been participating in the Watergate hearings, I know what the evidence was before us, and I might state that the indictments in the cover-up operations and also the Ellsberg burglary made by the grand jury are in perfect harmony with the evidence that was revealed before us. And I have some feelings about the evidence, but I think the House members who are not as familiar with it, the members of the House Judiciary Committee who are not as familiar with the evidence as the members of the Watergate Committee, need to have some testimony taken before them.
So you are anticipating a certain a particular result from all this, even though others may not be at this stage?
I don't know what the result will be, because I think that I don't know what the result will be, because I don't know what attitude the House Judiciary Committee is going to take in respect to impeachable offenses. But I would hope that they would confine it to criminal offenses, and criminal offenses which are crimes against government as distinguished from crimes against an individual. I don't, and high crimes, too, because the word high means something, and I don't think it means you can impeach a civil officer of the federal government for walking on the grass in violation. I think that's too insignificant, or I don't think you can impeach him if he is driving an automobile and negligent to kill somebody and thereby commits manslaughter, because that's an offense against the individual. So I think that it's against the government. For example, obstruction of justice would be an offense against the government. Or I think that a willful evasion of income taxes would be an offense against the government and therefore an impeachable offense, because government can't operate unless people pay taxes.
Senator, there's a great deal of talk on this particular subject, as you well know now, and it's, of course, vital in the interest of the Republic. Should articles of impeachment be passed by the House, as some people think they will be? Some don't, of course, but some do. Should they be? How do you think the Senate will vote?
I don't have any idea, because I haven't talked about any other senators, and I don't know how I would vote simply because I don't know what the articles of impeachment would be. In other words, you can only consider those articles of impeachment which are made by the House of Representatives. And I don't know what they're going to say, if anything.
Now, on procedural matters, there's a lot of questions being asked also. In a trial being held by the Senate, does all business of the Senate otherwise stop and only impeachment is considered?
Virtually so.
And
there's certain housekeeping arrangements that have to go on, but I would think it'd be up to the Senate to lay aside all other major business and act with as much dispatch as possible, as the fairness of the and thoroughness permit.
Now, I recall discussing this matter with a distinguished colleague of yours the other day, and the question came up that if indeed the House should pass articles of impeachment in this session, and then perhaps there wasn't enough time in this session for the Senate to try the case, that if the Senate had to try it in the next session, because it would be a new session of Congress, there would have to be a complete reorganization and impeachment proceedings begun again in the House.
I disagree, because the Supreme Court of the United States held in McGrane against Daugherty that the Senate is a continuing body. Although one third of its members go out, two-thirds remain. Now, what I said a while ago, I didn't mean that all work would stop, because there is a Senate rule under which the Senate can appoint a committee to take testimony and report to the committee. The testimony back to the Senate. Of course, that committee should continue to function, and the other part of the Senate could go ahead with other work.
In other words,
I think it ought to make it its prime purpose to move as fast as it can with fairness and thoroughness.
But your interpretation would be that should the House pass articles of impeachment in this session, the Senate then could immediately take it up in the next session if that is the way the time span works out.
Yes, the Senate could. Yes, Senate's a continuing body. That was raised in the question whether the Senate committee was making an investigation. The Congress expired, and the committee continued the investigation in the next session, and the Supreme Court held it was very proper because the Senate is a continuing body, always in existence, and unlike the House, which goes out completely at the end of every 2 years, only one-third of the Senate goes out.
Senator, there's another very important question that citizens have been asking, and it's this. Do you have any doubt in your mind that every member of the House, and if it comes to it, the Senate, will vote his conscience on this issue without any considerations of the political ramifications in his district?
Well, certainly that's the ideal thing that should be done. Human beings being what human beings are, sometimes they don't live up to the highest ideals, but if it's going to be a fair, just result, that's exactly what they would do. In other words, they ought to try the case just like a juror would sit on a case and hear the evidence to decide whether in the case of the Senate, whether the evidence sustains the allegations in the bill of impeachment.
Now, what happens in the Senate? The Chief Justice presides.
Yes.
Who tries and who's on the other side?
Well, the prosecution is conducted by a board of managers appointed by the House. These managers, of course, can get their own attorneys to assist them, but they are House members. They represent the prosecution in a sense. Then, of course, a person whose impeachment is sought can have his own counsel to protect his interests.
Okay.
And the Senate can make, as I understand, the Senate would make its own rules. It could overrule the Chief Justice's rule on a question of evidence by a majority vote.
And each side, as in a normal trial proceeding, could call in their witnesses? Is that how it works?
Yes. But probably the Senate would set up a special committee to take the testimony under the Senate rule rather than all of the senators sit there and hear it.
How long do you anticipate something like this might go on?
I have no way of knowing. I would hope that, as I said before, to move as much dispatch as fairness and thoroughness permitted.
Of course, assuming it ever comes about.
Yes.
I want to ask you one final question philosophically. A year ago, this whole subject of impeachment was unthinkable. Certainly, if it was thought of, nobody would mention it in polite conversation. What is your reaction after a year now that we're sitting down matter-of-factly discussing not only the subject of impeachment, but the procedures involved?
Well, after all, we're discussing one of our constitutional processes, which may be necessary under certain circumstances. I have consistently refrain from ever stating my opinion as to the president's involvement in any of these matters because of two reasons. In the first place, whether the president should be impeached is a matter for the House and not for the Senate. In the second place, if the House should prefer impeachment charges, the Senate would have to sit as a judge and jury. And also, I don't think our testimony is complete. Of course, John Dean was a very crucial witness before the committee. And the best evidence of whether John Dean testified truthfully or otherwise is evidence which has been in the possession of the president and which the president has withheld from the Watergate committee, and that's the tapes of September the 15th, 1972, February the 28th, 1973, and March the 13th and March the 21st, 1973. And I wouldn't want to make up my opinion until I've had heard what those tapes say.
In your opinion, Senator, I've always been curious about this. Do you feel that one of the great turning points in the Watergate investigation was Dean's testimony, or perhaps Butterfield's was more important?
Well, I think the two... President in the Oval Office in the White House and the executive office building had been taped, and that has caused a great deal of consternation, and the president's reluctance to surrender those tapes or permit them to be heard has also caused a great deal of consternation in the country. Say one thing, first, when the president started to raised claims of executive privilege way back last year, right after the committee was set up, I said I thought the American people were not interested in abstruse constitutional arguments about executive privilege or anything like that. All they were interested in was the truth, and I think it's been a great tragedy. The president has not revealed the tapes to the Watergate committee, to the grand juries, and to the federal judiciary.
Thank you, Senator Irvin, for being our guest. During the course of that day's session, the senator, as America had become accustomed to during the Watergate hearings, could not fail to refrain from expressing some of his long-held beliefs and philosophy. What follows may be collateral, to use the senator's word, to the principal subjects that were at hand, but it appears quite pertinent to the ongoing process that is at the root of the American political system.
Every person in a responsible office, or virtually every person in life, has a conflicting loyalties. Attorney General's appointed by the president. He has a certain loyalty to the president. He also owes, as you point out, obligations to the office which he occupies. And it recalled in my mind lecture I heard one time from a professor of philosophy at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Horace Williams. He said the great difficulties that we have in life and times that really try our souls is not when we are compelled to choose between good and evil, because that, as we see, when we see and recognize those two things, that choice is relatively simple. But that the greatest stress we ever meet is when we have to choose between conflicting loyalties. He said that each human being might be likened unto a dot in the middle of many concentric circles. That's the circles nearest to us represent our obligations to our families, others to our churches, others to our political party, or our country, or nation, or state. And at the times that try our souls when we have to choose between two conflicting loyalties and find out which one of them has the strongest demands on us. And I think that we've had two very fine illustrations in the tragedies we've gone through in the person of Attorney General Richardson and Deputy Attorney General Ruckelshaus, had to choose between conflicting loyalties, and I think they both made the wise and sound choice. We have one national affliction that we tend to succumb to, and that is that when something goes wrong, we want a new law passed. We don't always stop to consider how many laws we already have on the subject. And I frequently tell the college students when I have opportunity to speak to them, if we just could make everybody in the United States in public office and also in private affairs memorize Edgar Guest's little poem, myself, we wouldn't need so many laws. He says, I have to live with myself, and so I want to be fit for myself to know. I want to be able, as days go by, always to look myself straight in the eye. I don't want to stand with the setting sun and hate myself for the things I've done. And I think if we could make everybody in the United States memorize that thing, we could abolish a great many of the laws that we have on the books already.
Senator Sam Ervin, the North Carolina Democrat, speaking recently during hearings held by his subcommittee on the separation of powers. Sessions that have been trying to determine how the administration of justice can be buttressed against any possibility of political interference.